There can no longer be any doubt that we're dealing with some form of malignant insanity. A monster is abroad. Every cut is given with the unerring precision of the slaughterhouse. The police must find for us one of the most extraordinary monsters known to the history of mental and spiritual disease.
You are now entering London's East End to experience the Autumn of Terror. Please note that this episode contains adult themes and descriptions of violent crimes, which may not be suitable for all audiences. The use of the term prostitution is in no way intended to cause offence, but it will be used in this series for historical accuracy, as that is what it was referred to back then. Primary sources have been used as much as possible. This series has been created with the utmost respect for the victims in mind.
Hello and welcome back to Prasher's Murder Map. This is episode 3 of the Jack the Ripper mini-series. You might remember at the end of episode 2 we heard a newsboy calling out the latest headlines about another horrible murder, this time in Hanbury Street. It's Saturday, 8th of September 1888, just a day after the funeral of the Ripper's first canonical victim, Polly Nichols, who was viciously killed and eviscerated. Let's jump in a hansom cab and head to the new crime scene, which is less than half a mile away from the site of Polly's murder in Bucks Row. Here we are at 29 Hanbury Street. Let's speak to John Davis, the man who found the body. What can you tell us, John?
Well, I live on the top floor and I woke up at 5:45 this morning. I know because I heard the Spitalfields church clock. I had a cup of tea and went downstairs to the backyard. And would you believe it, there was a body lying near the bottom step.
I see. What did you do next?
I went to fetch a bobby. He came about 10 minutes later. Inspector Chandler, his name was. There was crowds of people around the house by that time. They must have heard the news.
Thanks, John. One of the many people thronging to hear the latest grisly news was Mrs. Harriet Hardiman, who lived on the ground floor of number 29 and ran a cat's meat shop, which is meat for cats to eat, not meat made from cats. But some people did buy it for themselves as it was so cheap. Mrs. Hardiman had heard a commotion and sent her son to investigate. He returned a few minutes later with disturbing news.
Don't upset yourself, Mother. It's a woman been killed in the yard.
Others were far from upset, and tenants of 29 Hanbury Street, with windows overlooking the backyard, charged curious sightseers a few pennies to gawk at the spot where the murder occurred. It beggars belief to us today that people would flock to view a horrific crime scene, perhaps even see the mutilated corpse if they got there early enough, and then go home for breakfast without a second thought, but unbelievably, this ghoulish tourism was common in the Victorian era. Before we go into the specifics of the murder and mutilation, I'll describe the scene. 29 Hanbury Street was owned by a woman called Amelia Richardson, who ran a packing case business in the cellar and shared a room on the first floor with her 14-year-old son. The other rooms were rented by various different residents. There were 8 rooms with a total of 17 people living in the building, but by the standards of the time, this wasn't considered overcrowded. It was in one of the better parts of Whitechapel, and most of the residents had regular jobs, except for an elderly widow who Amelia allowed to stay out of charity, even though she couldn't pay. There was only one door into the building, which opened into a narrow passageway, about 20 feet long but just 3 feet wide, leading to a staircase and continuing along to the back door. There were 3 stone steps down to a small square backyard with an outside lavatory in the top right-hand corner. Both the front and back doors were kept unlocked, as many houses were, because there was nothing worth stealing. There were other houses on either side of number 29, with adjacent backyards, and there was no way in or out except through the house, as the yard was completely enclosed by thin fences around 5.5 feet tall. The wounds on the body were more severe than those seen on Polly Nichols at Buck's Row just over a week before. This is the report by Inspector Chandler of H Division.
I went to 29 Hanbury Street, and through the passage into the yard I saw the body of a woman lying on the ground on her back, parallel with the fencing dividing the 2 yards. The deceased's legs were drawn up, and the clothing was above the knees. A portion of the intestines, still connected with the body, were lying above the right shoulder, with some pieces of skin. There were also some pieces of skin on the left shoulder. I sent for the divisional surgeon, Mr. Phillips, and saw that no one touched the body until he arrived. After the doctor examined the body and it was removed, I found in the yard a piece of coarse muslin, a small tooth comb, and a pocket hair comb in a case lying near the woman's feet. A portion of an envelope was found near her head. It contained 2 pills.
The victim was described as 5 feet tall with blue eyes, dark brown wavy hair, a pallid complexion, excellent teeth with just 2 missing, strongly built but undernourished, and suffering from a disease of the lungs and brain tissue. This could have referred to TB or perhaps syphilis, and the doctor who did the post-mortem, George Baxter Phillips, stated that had she not been murdered, she would have died imminently of her illnesses. She was wearing a long black coat that came down to her knees, a black skirt, 2 bodices, 2 petticoats, lace-up boots, red and white striped woolen stockings, a large pocket worn under the skirt and tied about the waist with strings, which was empty, and a red and white neckerchief. Marks on her fingers showed she'd been wearing 2 brass rings, but these had been stolen, presumably by the murderer, as a grim memento. At 11:30 a.m, a friend of the deceased woman identified her at the mortuary. The victim's name was Annie Chapman. This is her story. She was born Annie Eliza Smith in Paddington in September 1841, but her exact date of birth is unknown. She had 4 sisters and a brother, all younger than her. Her father was a soldier, but later entered domestic service as a valet. Tragically, when Annie was in her early 20s, and the youngest of her siblings, barely more than a baby, her father committed suicide by cutting his own throat. It's impossible to imagine the effect such a traumatic death would have had on the children. By that time, Annie had moved out of the family home and was following in her father's footsteps, working as a domestic servant. In May 1869, aged 27, Annie married another servant at her workplace, a coachman named John Chapman, and they lived in Windsor together. They had 2 daughters and a son, but sadly one of the girls, Emily Roof, suffered from seizures and died of meningitis, aged just 12. Their son was disabled and was sent to live in a special home. In those days, domestic servants weren't usually allowed to marry or have children, so John and Annie must have been liked and trusted by their employers to have won this privilege. In some ways, this makes Annie Chapman's story even more poignant, because she'd had a relatively comfortable, respectable life before her sudden fall from grace. She's the only victim we have a photograph of when she was still alive. It was taken the year of her marriage and shows her sitting in a chair while her husband John stands next to her. Both are well dressed and Annie's hair is neatly braided. At one point, John even secured a job as a servant to a nobleman, a very prestigious position. After their daughter's death in 1882, they began drinking heavily, and Annie was often seen wandering the countryside, unaware and intoxicated. She was arrested several times and held in jail until she sobered up. Annie and John agreed to part ways 2 or 3 years later, and John retained custody of the children. The split wasn't on bad terms and he continued paying her 10 shillings a week until his death in 1886 from cirrhosis of the liver and dropsy, an old-fashioned term for edema or swelling, possibly caused by heart failure. Many years later, Annie's sister Miriam wrote a letter to a minister in support of the temperance movement, describing how she had tried to prevent her sister's drinking.
Just before I was 6 years old, my father cut his throat, leaving my mother with 5 children. My eldest sister took to drink when she was quite young. 12 years ago, I heard a sermon on Christians and total abstinence. I signed the pledge with 2 of my sisters, and we tried to persuade the one given to drink to give it up. She was married and in a good position. Over and over again, she signed the pledge and tried to keep it. Over and over again, she was tempted and fell. She said it was no use. No one knew the fearful struggle, and that unless she could keep out of sight or smell, she could never be free. For years, we wrestled with God in prayer for her. She could not keep sober, so she left her husband and 2 children. We never knew where she lived. She used to come to us at home now and then. We gave her clothes and tried in every way to win her back, for she was a mere beggar. She said she would always keep out of our way, but she must and would have drink.
It's sad to hear how Annie struggled with alcohol addiction, and I wonder if there'd been access to support groups and a better understanding of mental health as there is today, whether her life would have turned out very differently. Maybe all she needed was help in coming to terms with her daughter's death and a healthier way of dealing with the grief. After John Chapman died, Annie had no choice but to move to the East End of London, the only place she could afford. She earned money by selling crochet work and flowers, but eventually turned to prostitution. Despite splitting from her husband, she'd been visibly upset when she heard the news of his death, and soon after this she gained the nickname Dark Annie, because she always appeared depressed or downcast. Her friend Amelia Palmer noticed she was sad whenever she spoke of her children, and that since her husband's death, she seemed to have given up. At this time, Annie was living with a sieve maker called John Civy at a common lodging house in Dorset Street, one of the worst parts of Whitechapel, known for its violence and criminal element, so much so that policemen refused to go down there alone. We know it was one of the worst streets thanks to a poverty map created by social reformer Charles Booth, who undertook a research study between 1886 and 1903, mapping out the income and working conditions of each household, colouring in each dwelling according to their status, ranging from upper and upper middle classes, wealthy to lowest class, vicious, semi-criminal. Sadly, Dorset Street was one of the latter. As soon as Civy heard about John's death, he left Annie, probably because the weekly 10 shillings stopped coming in. In August 1888, just weeks before she was murdered, Annie bumped into her younger brother, Fountain Smith, on Commercial Road. She told him she was struggling financially, and he gave her 2 shillings. That was the last time he ever saw her alive. That year, Annie was in a relationship with Ted Stanley, a bricklayer's mate known locally as the Pensioner. This wasn't because of his advanced age, as he was only 47, but because he was drawing a military pension under false pretenses, claiming he'd been in the army. By now, Annie had started practicing sex work to keep a roof over her head. By the time of her death, she was living at Crossingham's lodging house at 35 Dorset Street. Crossingham was the name of the owner, who also ran several other lodging houses, but this one had room for around 300 people and was managed by a man called Timothy Donovan. Stanley the pensioner often paid for Annie's bed there and instructed Donovan to turn her away if she ever tried to enter with another man. He often spent the weekends with Annie at Crossingham's, but this arrangement wasn't exclusive. He also paid for a bed for another woman, Eliza Cooper. At the end of August 1888, Annie and Eliza got into a fight over a borrowed bar of soap.
Can I have the soap back now, Annie?
I will see you by and by.
The discussion continued the next time they saw each other.
Perhaps you return my soap now?
Here you are. Go and get half penny with the soap with this.
But the argument wasn't over and continued in the Britannia public house, known as Ringers, on the corner of Dorset Street and Commercial Street. Annie slapped Eliza in the face.
Think you say I'm lucky I don't do more?
In return, Eliza punched Annie in the left eye and breast. On 4th of September, Amelia Palmer ran into Annie and gave her 2 pence, as she said she wasn't feeling well and hadn't eaten or drunk. Annie said she was going to the casual ward, a part of the workhouse where the homeless could stay for one night in return for hard work. On Friday, 7th of September, Amelia and Annie crossed paths again in Dorset Street.
Hello, Annie. Are you going to Stratford today to look for clients?
No, I'm feeling too ill to do anything much today.
A few minutes passed and Amelia came back again.
Are you still not moved?
It's no use my giving way. I must pull myself together and go out and get some money, or I shall have no lodgings.
She didn't have any luck because at 11:30 p.m, she returned to her lodging house and sat in the kitchen for a while. A male lodger shared a pint of beer with her, then Annie left around 1 a.m. to get some food. She returned at 1:30 with a potato. Donovan, the lodging house manager, soon came in.
Have you got your dust money for tonight?
I haven't sufficient money for my bed. Don't let it. I shan't be long before I'm in.
You can find money for your beer, and you can't find money for your bed.
Never mind, Tim. I'll soon be back.
Despite still feeling unwell, she left Dorset Street and walked up Little Paternoster Row towards Brushfield Street. By now, it was about 1:50 a.m. At 4:40 a.m. at 29 Hanbury Street, John Richardson, son of the landlady, Amelia Richardson, went through the passageway and sat on the steps leading into the backyard to trim some leather off his boot with a knife. He didn't live there but regularly went to the house to check on the cellar, which had been broken into before. Although the sun hadn't fully risen, it would have been light enough for him to see a body if it had been there, but he saw and smelt nothing. At 5:15 a.m, witness Elizabeth Long saw Annie with a man just outside 29 Hanbury Street. She heard the man say, "Will you?" and Annie replied, "Yes." She described him as dark, about 40 years old, a little taller than Annie, and wearing a brown deerstalker hat. If you're not sure what a deerstalker hat looks like, just imagine Sherlock Holmes. Some sources say Long thought the man looked like a foreigner, although she only saw him from the back. Others say it was his accent she described as foreign. This was the last time anyone saw Annie Chapman alive. Sometime between 5:15 and 5:20, carpenter Albert Kadosh, who lived next door at number 27, went into his backyard to relieve himself in the lavatory. He had a urinary tract infection, so he went twice in about 5 minutes. On the first occasion, he heard a woman saying no, and the second time, he heard something fall against the fence. He thought little of it, as the backyard of number 29 was often used by prostitutes, although the owner, Mrs. Richardson, vehemently denied it. By now, the sun was up, and had Albert looked over the fence, he would almost certainly have seen the face of Jack the Ripper. There was some controversy over the timings, as Elizabeth Long originally put her sighting of Annie and the man at 5:30, as she had just heard the church clock chime. But matching up the events in Kadosh's statement, it was most likely the quarter past chime that she heard. We have to remember that people around Whitechapel wouldn't have been wealthy enough to own watches, so they had to rely on church clocks, and sometimes they ran a few minutes fast or slow, so it's difficult to be exact. Now, I'm going to go and see the coroner and ask if he'll mind if we listen in on the inquest while he interviews police surgeon Dr. George Baxter Phillips. Wait here for a moment and soak up the ambience.
They've said it's an old liberator. He's been bothering me for months. I don't suppose I'll live that much longer. That's another thing that pleases me.
There's been another one.
Where?
Down Hanbury Street. Police say she was gutted like a fish.
Thanks for waiting. The coroner's agreed, so let's go in and hear some of the proceedings. But be warned, it's not for the faint-hearted.
The body of the deceased was lying in the yard on her back, on the left of the steps leading from the passage. The face was swollen, and the tongue protruded between the front teeth. The small intestines and other portions were lying on the right side of the body, on the ground above the shoulder, but attached. There was a large quantity of blood, with part of the stomach above the left shoulder. The throat was dissevered deeply, the jagged incision reaching right round the neck. On the back wall of the house were patches of blood, and on the wooden fence were smears corresponding to the deceased's head. I believe breathing was interfered with before death, and death arose from failure of the heart's action, due to the loss of blood caused by the severance of the throat. I believe the killer took hold of her by the chin, then commenced the incision from left to right. Was the instrument used at the throat the same as that used at the abdomen? Probably. It must have been a very sharp knife with a thin, narrow blade, at least 6 to 8 inches in length. Is it possible that any instrument used by a military man, such as a bayonet, would have done it? No, not a bayonet.
You might remember that the doctor who examined Martha Tabram's body back in early August believed that the final one of the 39 stab wounds on her body might have been made with a soldier's bayonet, hence Dr. Phillips' question.
Would it have been such an instrument as a medical man uses for post-mortems? The ordinary post-mortem case does not contain such a weapon. Would any instrument that horse slaughterers employ have caused the injuries? Yes, well ground down. Would the knife of a cobbler or of any person in the leather trades have done? I think the knife used in those trades would not be long enough in the blade. Was there any anatomical knowledge displayed? I think there was.
Phillips' post-mortem report provided even more ghastly detail.
The abdomen was entirely laid open, the intestines lifted out of the body and placed on the shoulder, the uterus and its appendages, the upper portion of the vagina and the posterior two-thirds of the bladder were entirely removed. No trace of these parts was found, and the incisions were cleanly cut. The work was that of an expert who had such knowledge of anatomical or pathological examinations as to be able to secure the pelvic organs with one sweep of the knife, which must have been at least 5 or 6 inches long. I myself could not have performed all the injuries described in under a quarter of an hour.
Coroner Wynne Baxter was thorough and incisive in his questioning, and would become well known for his involvement in the inquest of the Jack the Ripper victims. Once again, the verdict was willful murder by person or persons unknown. Whether or not the killer really did have anatomical knowledge would be hotly debated throughout the years. Police were no closer to finding the killer of Polly Nichols or Annie Chapman. The investigation was led by Inspectors Abilene Helson and Chandler. Inspector Edmund Reed, who we heard about in previous episodes, was on holiday at the time. The house and all its inhabitants at 29 Hanbury Street had been questioned, and all the witnesses gave satisfactory accounts of their whereabouts. Even Ted Stanley, the fake pensioner, after a lengthy cross-examination by the acerbic Wynne Baxter. Over the years, a myth has been built up around Annie's possessions found at the crime scene, with some people claiming they were arranged deliberately and symbolically at her feet by the killer, which wasn't true. The scrap of envelope with two pills inside seemed at first to be a tantalising clue, as it bore the seal of the Sussex Regiment and was stamped London, 28th of August 1888, with a partial address visible. But any hopes that this could lead to the killer were dashed when a fellow lodger at Dorset Street, William Stevens, came forward to say he'd seen Annie pick up the discarded envelope from the floor of the lodging house and used it to store her pills because she'd accidentally broken the box she usually kept them in. By the end of the inquest, a Whitechapel Vigilance Committee had been formed in the Crown Public House on Mile End Road, not far from the murder sites. Irishman George Lusk was elected as president, and the group's mission was to help the police by looking out for suspicious characters. Everyone in the area was scared, on edge, and wound as tight as a coiled spring. How could the killer have escaped into the light of the early morning, covered with blood? How could anyone be so bold as to commit murder in the backyard of a house inhabited by 17 people? And above all, what possible malevolent, black-hearted use did he have for the body parts he'd taken from the scene? The post-mortem report we heard may shed some light on how bloody the killer would really have been, as it suggests that Annie was strangled and then lowered to the ground before her throat was cut, which would have led to lowered blood pressure and therefore less blood splatter, so this might explain why he didn't stand out in his appearance. But I think it's safe to say he must have lived close by, as the risk of him being noticed would be greater the more streets he had to traverse to reach home. Lurid articles were splashed across the newspapers, reflecting the public disbelief that a human being could murder and mutilate so heinously. Here's an extract from the Daily News printed on 10th of September, 1888.
Annie Chapman's head was nearly severed from her body by one stroke of a knife, and her mangled remains disposed about her in a way that suggested delight in the slaughter. All was done in half an hour. The house teemed with life. It was near the hour of rising, yet no one heard a cry. The swiftness, the perfect mystery of it all, are heightening effects of terror. There can no longer be any doubt that we're dealing with some form of malignant insanity. A monster is abroad. Every cut is given with the unerring precision of the slaughterhouse. The police must find for us one of the most extraordinary monsters known to the history of mental and spiritual disease. The public are looking for a monster, and in the legend of Leather Apron, they seem to be inventing one to look for. This should be discouraged, or there may soon be murders from panic to add to murders from lust of blood. A touch would fire the whole district in the mood which it is now. Leather Apron walks without making a noise, with piercing eyes and a strange smile, and Leather Apron looks like a Jew. This has already had its effect in a cry against Whitechapel Jews. Already, as our column shows today, the list of savage assaults in the neighborhood has increased alarmingly. Every man who can say a reasonable word ought to say it, or worse may follow.
This paper was right to advise against spreading rumors. Early police inquiries had turned up a possible suspect in the shape of a man known only as Leather Apron. Prostitutes in the area reported being harassed by him and that he would threaten to rip them up with a knife unless they gave him money. This was made even more sensational by the news that a leather apron had been found in the yard at the murder scene, recently washed and left to dry out. In fact, this belonged to John, Amelia Richardson's son, who'd used it while mending the cellar door. Unfortunately, this didn't stop an angry mob nearly killing Polish-Jewish boot finisher John Pizer, who was also known as Leather Apron. He had a solid alibi and thankfully received compensation after some of the more unscrupulous newspapers cast suspicion on him. There was concern amongst authorities about the anti-Jewish sentiment in Whitechapel, and the Leather Apron incident did nothing to allay their fears. There was a big Jewish community in the area of almost 50,000, as many had fled from their homes in Eastern Europe after the pogroms in Russia. They were scapegoated for the assassination of Tsar Alexander II and often found their way to the East End of London, thanks to its proximity to the docks. Many were successful business owners, butchers, bootmakers, or various other professions, but the influx meant worsening overcrowding in Whitechapel and Spitalfields, which increased conflict and provoked anti-Semitism. At this time, the East End was near boiling point, and senior police officials feared imminent civil unrest if relation between Jews and non-Jews broke down further. And painting a shadowy, monstrous picture of the murderer as a Jew wasn't going to help. The idea that the Whitechapel murderer was Jewish would pervade popular thought for the next century. But this may not be the truth at all, and we'll explore this in more detail in episode 7 of this mini-series, when we tackle the colourful cast of suspects. Annie Chapman was buried on 14th of September 1888 at Manor Park Cemetery in Forest Gate, in a private ceremony attended only by her family. Today, the site of her grave is completely lost because a plot has since been used to bury new bodies twice over. Her two surviving children were cared for by relatives, having tragically lost both their parents at a young age. Hanbury Street has now been completely transformed into a covered car park and weekend marketplace, but can be seen as it once was in a YouTube clip filmed in the 1960s during the making of TV programme The London Nobody Knows. My wife and I were fortunate enough to go on a walking tour of the murder sites back in 2011, led by author and ripperologist Philip Hutchinson. I'm honoured to announce that Philip will be making an appearance in episode 6 to voice two characters, so be sure to listen out for that. I'll also be putting links to his books, Ripper Tour and Theatre Company in the show notes. All the murder sites look vastly different now from how they did back in 1888. But if you visit in the dark and use your imagination, you can still just about envision those narrow, dimly lit passageways and the flicker of gaslights. If you listen, you might even hear the ghostly echo of footsteps. The footsteps of the blood-soaked demon who still stalks the streets in our imaginations. But let's not forget that the killer was still being referred to at this time as the Whitechapel murderer or the Whitechapel fiend. He didn't yet have a name, but he was just about to get one.
Extra, extra, letter sent by the killer. Read all about it. Killer's own words. He's given himself a name.
That was good timing. As I was saying, on 27th September 1888, the London Central News Agency received a chilling letter.
Dear boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about leather apron gave me real fits. I am down on horse and I shan't quit ripping them till I do get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave the lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work and I want to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little games. I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope. The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send them to the police officers just for jolly. Wouldn't you? Keep this letter back till I do a bit more work, then give it out straight. My knife's so nice and sharp. I want to get to work right now if I get a chance. Good luck. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper. Don't mind me giving the trade name. Wasn't good enough to post this before I got all the red ink off me hands. curse it. No luck yet. They say I'm a doctor now.
Thank you for listening to part 3 of this Jack the Ripper mini-series. If you enjoyed it, please consider taking the time to leave me a review and feel free to get in touch with any comments or suggestions. This podcast is completely independent, and I do all the research, writing and editing myself with help from my wife, with an amateur setup literally in our spare bedroom at home. It's costly to produce, so any support you can give me via one-off donations via PayPal or as a Patreon supporter are greatly appreciated. Patreon supporters can access this entire mini-series already, so you don't have to wait for the next episodes to come out. And there is access to other random bonus content with more rewards coming soon. Links are in the show notes. Thanks everyone for your support. Join me again next time as the Autumn of Terror continues with the much disputed double event. Were both these murders really the work of the same man? Until then, take care everyone.